difficulties this morning. And, you know, that's par for the course. I am Shannon Penrod, and you're watching Autism Live in the only way that we can come to you today. And sometimes that's just the deal. I want you guys to know that we've been doing this now. We are coming up on the 11th anniversary of how long we've been doing this show. And there have been times, we're in the third studio that we've ever been in, and it takes a year off of my life every time we move a studio. There was a period of time in which we thought we were going to have to go live from a men's bathroom. You know, you do what you have to do. And I'm glad that we're here this morning, and I'm glad that you guys stuck it out, because we're going to talk about some things today that have the potential to change your lives. And I don't say that lightly, because, you know, every show, we don't, you know, maybe we have a message that isn't for you, and you're like, I don't have a small child anymore. What you're saying, Shannon, has nothing to do with me, right? Or other times you're like, you know, you're talking about college. I have a three-year-old. It has nothing to do with me. But today, the things that we're going to talk about have to do with everybody. So I'm really excited to be here and thrilled, and want to thank our producer, Traven, who just works and works and works until we have a way to get live. And that is the most important thing. So thrilled to be here with you, although late. And the chat is open. I want you guys to know that if you have stuck with us and you're here, or you're just tuning in, we're here and we're excited to be here this morning. We're going to be live for the next hour. We'll go late. We do that anyway, right? And we're going to be talking to you. I do want to tell you that this is one of those shows. We're doing a special series this summer, Parent to Parent, where I talk to you about a subject and give you the lowdown on what I have found out over the years. Because I am a parent. I identify as a proud pony, a parent of a neurodiverse individual. That's who I am. And this morning I read a really important, I think, blog post detailing about the difference between self-advocates and parents, because we know that sometimes it's not, it's contentious. I won't say that it's not a great working relationship, but sometimes there's some contention between adults on the spectrum and parents because there's a lot of misconnection. And I love this post because it said, you know, we're both seeing things from a different point of view, but both points of view are really super valid. And that if we just listen to each other, and I know that's the place that I'm coming from always, that I want to be 100% clear here that what I'm saying does not encompass the experience from a person who is actually autistic. I'm not trying to give advice because I don't know. I don't know. I ask a lot of questions, but I'm never going to know, right? What that's like. But what I do know, and the lane that I want to try to stay in, is as a parent, how can I help all of you that are out there, whether you yourself are the person on the spectrum, whether you are a person on the spectrum who is a parent, whether you are, you know, a 16-year-old who's on the spectrum, whether you are a caregiver, you know, maybe you're an aunt, an uncle, a grandparent, or a sibling, or you're a person who works in the field of autism. I feel like there's a perspective from being a parent many years on this journey that I can provide, that hopefully the intent is to be helpful to all of you to get to the place that you're trying to get to, which is very individual for everybody. So we have to be very careful about not ever saying that there's one size fits all. However, there is the human experience, right? And it doesn't matter whether you are on the spectrum or not on the spectrum, you're having a human experience. And what we're going to be talking today is about what are some things that have to do with being human, and if we understood those things, could we get to a happier, more productive life? So that's, because today we're talking about the four usual suspects. And in just a second, hello, Louise, how's Massachusetts? So thrilled that you're here. So when you understand what the four usual suspects are and how to be mindful of them, I feel like it's the key to happiness. That for happiness for you and for other people and to getting good communication, regardless of how the person communicates, a really good thing. And I always think of it as like a lineup, the four usual suspects. So we're going to talk about that first in a second. But first, I want to say that we are live right now on Facebook, on YouTube, on Twitter, all those different sites. The chat is open. You can be writing in directly to us. We're live right now. If you're watching us later and it's not Monday morning, I don't even know what today's date is. That's how discombobulated I am today. It is the 22nd. I love the 22nd. If you're not watching us on Monday morning, the 22nd live, and you're watching us later recorded, you can still write into us. There's a lot of different ways to get in touch with us. Eventually, Traven will try to put those on the screen to show you the different ways. Hello, our Journey Cameron's New Life. So thrilled that you are here. So you can reach out to us in any of those ways. I always like to remind you that you can always reach me directly. My email is shannon@autism-live.com. shannon@autism-live.com. I love to hear from you. If you don't hear back from me fairly immediately, please do me a favor and be persistent and write me again, because, you know, I try really hard to get back in a timely manner, because when I don't, if I open an email and I don't respond right away, sometimes it goes into the ether that is my brain. So be kind. We get a lot of mail. I tried to do the best I can. Don't assume that I don't care. Just assume that I missed it and write again. Liliana, good morning. How are you? How's Riverside this morning? It's very gray here in Los Angeles today, and it feels moist. It feels like almost the beginning of fall. It feels back to school, which for a lot of people, it is back to school. Okay. I also want to say to you guys that we have been sharing some really important information here, and we're going to continue to do that because this is important to me personally, that you guys get good information in a timely manner. You may remember that it was a couple of months ago that we covered a story, because we cover research when it happens that we think is important to you. So the National Institute for Health, in conjunction with John Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, published a study. And it suggested, everybody fasten your seatbelts, it suggested that babies that were exposed to acetaminophen, during pregnancy had a significantly higher risk of later being diagnosed with autism. So if a mom took a product that had acetaminophen in it, and we're, you know, it's any product that had acetaminophen in it, we're talking Tylenol, we're talking Excedrin, things of that nature, that, and they were taking it for pain medicine, right? And the doctor was saying that this was a good thing to do. It's over the counter. You know, we were all told this, right? But that in fact, those women had a much higher risk of later having their child be diagnosed with autism. So research is ongoing on this, but it is such a big deal that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration began urging, after this study came out, that pregnant women cease all different types of pain-relieving products during pregnancy. Now, that's huge, right? But on the other side of that, I think what's huge, you know, you might be sitting there saying, well, wait a second, I took one of these, I took acetaminophen when I was pregnant. I was told by my doctor that I could, that it was safe. And now I have one, two, potentially more children on the autism spectrum. What do I do with this information now? And I got you. I so have you today. So I'm going to read this to you. If you or a loved one used Tylenol or other medications containing acetaminophen while pregnant and later gave birth to a child diagnosed with autism, you may be entitled to financial compensation. The law firm of Shapiro Legal Group is now evaluating potential legal claims by parents of autistic children, and I personally urge you to call them. It's Shapiro Legal Group. Call them today to see if you qualify, because you may qualify for financial compensation. And please, I'm asking you to spread this message to your friends in the community who might be unaware of this. It's very important that you do so. There are time deadlines to file, so I really want to urge you to call today. Don't wait. You can reach Shapiro Legal Group. Here's the phone number. Are you ready? 888-657-0455. I'm going to say that to you again slowly. 888-657-0455. There are operators standing by. You can also contact Shapiro Legal Group by going to their website, and you can fill out a form there. Their website is shapirolegalgroup.com/autism. Again, that's shapirolegalgroup.com
/autism. I also have to read to you Shapiro Legal Group, PLLC, associates with attorneys throughout the country to help people nationwide, is licensed in New York and Washington, D.C., and has its principal office at 60 East 42nd Street, New York, New York. And I need to remind you that this ad was read by a non-attorney spokesperson. I am the non-attorney spokesperson who read it. You guys all know me. Laurie, I'm so glad that you're here. I think we need to show that disclaimer just a little bit longer on the screen there, Traven, if you would for me. There you go. There's that phone number again, you guys. 888-657-0455. I'm going to ask you to do me a favor. And if you took Tylenol, Excedrin, anything that had acetaminophen, please call them today. But more importantly, not more importantly, equally importantly, if you have friends in the community that also need to call, I'm going to ask you to share that important information with them. This is the important stuff, you guys. Okay, so glad that we had an opportunity to bring that to you this morning. That's important, important news. Okay, so our topic today is the four usual suspects. And, you know, as I said, we got on a little bit late this morning because we're having all kinds of technical issues, which comes, there's something about the summer. We always have more technical issues in the summer. I don't know whether it's the humidity or the dryness. You know, it's one of the, it's always something, right? But also because we're pretty new in this studio, so, you know, we're working out the kinks here. But I'm going to be referring, we've been showing you my PowerPoint on the screen, but that's what we can't make happen today because it's being fussy. But we have a PowerPoint, and if you'd like to have the PowerPoint at a later date, you can write to me, Shannon@autism-live. Any of the PowerPoints that we've been doing during this parent-to-parent, you can write to me. We're happy to share that with you. So first of all, we're going to talk about the four usual suspects. And these are the four usual suspects. Whenever you guys ask this all the time, why is my child doing X, whatever it is? And here's your answer. It's usually one of these four usual suspects. I will tell you that there's an asterisk after that because there's a fifth one that we're going to talk about before we're done. But there's four main reasons why your kiddo is doing something. So my first question that I want to ask you and ask you to, yes, thank you, Emnas. I appreciate you writing in about the acetaminophen. Very important to spread the word. Okay, but back to behavior. You know, the first question that we have to ask is it random? And I know it's a beginner question, but you know, we all have to be beginners somewhere and start somewhere, right? Is it random? So let's say pick any behavior, and you guys can be writing in a behavior that your kids do. And it could be a behavior that isn't a problem, or it could be a behavior that is a problem, right? But you will notice at some point that there will be something that your child will do that you will go, I don't think I've seen that before. I've never seen a kid do that before. I had never seen a kid line up their cars before I had a child on the spectrum, right? And I was like, what's that about? What is that about? And I, you know, then my child was diagnosed with autism, and a lot of times whoever diagnoses somebody says to you, oh, well, they're just doing that because they have autism, which is no explanation. And we always want to know why, right? So I think it's important to lay groundwork and say that behavior is not random. And that it's not, there's no behavior that's weird or odd. When we see a kid who is playing with a string and he takes a piece of yarn and he goes like this, there are a lot, and they'll shake it and they'll do that. And a lot of people look at that and go, well, that's just weird. But that's from a place of ignorance. That's what that is. That's, or as my, you know, my uncle would say, that's just ignorant, right? That's a place of ignorance. If we can come from a place as a group of people to have this discussion and say behaviors aren't random, there is no random behavior, everything is happening for a reason, then we have a basis to look at it and we can, you know, I'm going to say this, we can look at scientifically. And on the one hand, we're going to look at this scientifically, but we're going to look at what is the feeling and the emotion and the why behind it. Not just the dry as a stick in Texas science, which sometimes is a little yawn, right? But the you know, what's the story behind it, right? So there is no random. Let's just take that out of our vocabulary. And isn't that a relief if you say to yourself, okay, my child is right now throwing a tantrum. It's not random. Something is happening in this moment. And I'm going to give you the big spoiler alert. It's all about communication. What do we want more than anything else in the world? If we're parents and we have kiddos that are on the spectrum, kiddos, teens, adults on the spectrum, we want to be able to communicate with them. Is that not true? Can I get an amen on that? Because I think at the core, that's what every... Look at Traven. Look at how good he is. The PowerPoint is back. Yay, Traven. If we start to look at it and go, if this is them communicating, then it is incumbent upon us to next ask, what is it that they're trying to communicate? What is it that they want? Oh, you're so fabulous. Thank you. Do they have any other way to get what they want right now aside from the behavior that they're engaged in? Can we teach them a better way to get what they want? I want to pause for a second, and I want to go over that last statement again. Can we teach them a better, and by better, I mean easier for them, way to get what they want? Because here is the thing. Life is better when you can get your needs met effectively. Can we all agree that that is true for absolutely all of us? And so if we begin, if we toss out this idea that behavior is random, any behavior, and we say, okay, this is the person communicating, doesn't that just automatically take the sting out of whatever is happening? If your child is throwing a tantrum, instead of going, oh no, you know, why is this happening? Why is this happening to me? Why can't we just have, you know, whatever? Instead, if you ask, what are they trying to communicate me? Now you got a job, you got something to do. And if you, the next question is, what is it that they want? And is there any other way they can get it? And have we taught them how they can get that need met without throwing the tantrum? Can we cue the angel music, right? This is what we're talking about here, and this is for everybody. But when you have trouble communicating your needs through all the different reasons why that might be, right? Maybe you don't know what you need. Boy, I've been there before, right? Or maybe you know, but you can't communicate it to the other person. It's frustration. It's absolutely frustration. And the best moments are in life are when we're able to get our needs met effectively. Now, I always tell the story about when it was our 10th wedding anniversary, my husband and I took our son and we went to Vegas for a couple of days to celebrate our 10th. If you know us, you know this is so unlike us. We don't do this, but we're going to make a big deal out of it because it's our 10th wedding anniversary. And we bought tickets to see Cirque du Soleil Mystère. And we're so thrilled that we were going to, and it was so hot, and we were so excited to be in an air-conditioned theater, and they said, come early because there's a pre-show. We couldn't wait, and it seemed like not very many people knew about it. We got into the theater, and sitting in the next level down from us were two older parents with, I'm assuming, their daughter, who was in a wheelchair and was non-vocal. And a magician came out and is doing this amazing thing. And the theater is not even, you know, a tenth full. And so it's really exciting. We're there. We're seeing this. And he's interactive. He's interacting with the audience. But the girl in the wheelchair began to make noises. And she began, it was an electric wheelchair. And she had the controls. And she began pushing the controls to go back. And her parents were like, no, we're here, we're going to watch the show, we're not leaving, we're here. And she started to make louder noises. And they kept trying to calm her and say, no, we're watching the show, we're watching the show. And then she just reached up and whapped the mom in the face and started making very loud noises. And I, oh my gosh, my heart bled for this parent who now we've all seen her be hit and we're all having this moment with, and we can't watch the magician anymore. We're in this moment with them. And I was trying really hard not to stare and watch the magician, but it's hard. It's in my line of vision and it's hard. It's hard to look away, but I understood what it felt like. Not completely, right? But I understood what it's like when your child
even if it's an adult child, is having this issue in public and then hits you and you're dealing with all the eyeballs on you. Man, I just felt for this mom. And, you know, the dad was like, that's it, we're out. And they packed up and they, you know, started out the theater because what are they going to do, right? And I felt so bad. And the magician finishes up, does whatever, and there's like 5 minutes before the show is going to start. And I said to my husband, I'm going to use the ladies' room while there's a break. And I went into the ladies' room, and who's in the ladies' room but the mom and the young woman in the wheelchair. And it was evident, she was totally calm at this point, and it was evident that what she needed was to go to the bathroom. She, all that time, you know, how, if you don't have a way to tell someone that you have to go to the bathroom, you know, she made some sounds, she pushed her wheelchair back because she was going to go herself, and then they were telling her no. And so then she made louder noises to tell them I have to go to the bathroom, and they weren't listening, and so she hit her mom, which is when they finally listened, right? And I stood there, and I felt so bad for everyone because she didn't have a better way to communicate that she needed to go to the bathroom. So that whole thing, if we just had had a way of communicating with her, could have been avoided. And I had already learned this because my son was already done with his intensive ABA by this point. But it occurred to me how vital and important it is for everybody to know this information. It's all about the communication. So the next time someone in your life, whether it's your kiddo on the spectrum or your partner or your business associate, the next time that they're engaged in a behavior that you're having a hard time with, ask yourself what these questions. What is being communicated? What is it they want? Do they have any other way of getting what they want? Because you know what? If they don't, then of course they're going to do it this way. We all will. You and I will too, right? But is there a way that we can teach the people with us how to get their needs met without this behavior? So, you know, if you have, I'm just thinking about in our old office, we had an employee that would eat other people's lunches. They just would do this, and they didn't even feel bad about it, right? This was not a person on the spectrum. This is just a person in an office eating lunches, and it was making other people angry, right? And so, you know, what was being communicated was that this person had some issues and needed to eat and didn't plan ahead. That was what they wanted, and they were going to do it no matter what. And they weren't somebody who planned well enough to, you know, be able to have their lunch. You know, one person, it wasn't me, had a discussion with this person's wife and said, are you aware of the fact that he's sometimes so hungry that he eats other people? And then she sent him with a lunch forevermore. Now, would I like it for him to learn that for himself? Yes. But is that my place? No. And he stopped eating other people's lunches. I'm just saying. We can look at what's happening in a way and go, what's really happening? And it's all about the communication. And we all want to lead a better life. So, okay, function, what's the function? Do you remember Schoolhouse Rock and they would do conjunction, junction, what's your function? Well, I always sing that song whenever I think about function. Function, what's the function? So behaviorists will talk about this. We're going to go to the science now, and they say that every behavior that happens more than once, I mean, sometimes you do a behavior just to try it out, right? To see, does it work? And you quickly see that it doesn't work, right? But if you do a behavior over and over and over again, it has a function. There is a need, excuse me, that's trying to be met. And if the behavior happens often enough, then it means that there is some sort of a payoff, even though it may not be effective or efficient. You're getting whatever it is that you wanted, which is the function. You know, what I wanted was your attention, and I got it, right? So what's the reason that you're doing it? What's the purpose behind it? And if it shows enough reward to make you hopeful that it will get better, you will continue to do it that way, especially if you don't have another way. And a lot of times people feel like they don't have another way, and sometimes they're not wrong. But this is where teaching comes into place. Excuse me, if we can teach people a more effective way of getting done what they want to do, their life gets better, and the people around them, their life gets better too. But I want to stay focused on the fact that it really is about making life better for the person themselves, because that's the truth. And if we stick on that page, it's harder to mess this up, and we don't want to mess this up. Okay, so let's talk about what are the four usual suspects, and there's your asterisk, right? So when, especially when we're talking about people who are preteens, it's almost always some combination of these four. Once we get into teenage years, we're going to deal with the asterisk. I will bring you that one later, okay? But let's go through these. Tangible, attention, escape, and automatic. Okay, so those are the four, and we're going to go through them one by one and talk about what they are and what the interventions are once you realize which one that it is. So a tangible. Tangible can be a person or a thing, or you want access to something. It's when somebody wants something or someone. So let's say that Billy is at the store and he sees these luscious donuts and he wants one. And if he wants it bad enough, Billy will do anything to get the donut. We all know somebody in our lives that's a donut lover, right? And they will do all kinds of things. I remember my little nephew, my mother was having a garage sale, and my sister-in-law brought over a box of donuts, and my mother and my nephew, two of the biggest donut-aholics I've ever met in my entire life, my nephew was like about to be four, right? And I remember everybody's working, setting up the garage sale, and he knew that he could not have a donut unless he asked for one. So apparently what happened, we found out later, is that he went up to my mother and said, "Grandma, can I please have a donut?" And she was like, "Of course, pumpkin. Which one would you like?" And he scarfed up the donut and ate the donut and was happy, right? And then he wanted another donut. And he knew that if he asked Grandma, she was going to say, "No, you've had one donut. That's all that a three-year-old body should have is one donut." So he didn't ask her. He went to his mom and said, "Mom, can I have a donut?" And she was like, "Of course, sweetheart, you can have a donut." So by the time, you know, he threw up, and he did, we discovered that he'd gone to six different people, and we'd all signed off on him having a donut. Because he was three, and he didn't know when to stop. And I think it's important for us to realize that, you know, sometimes people want things that aren't good for them. And sometimes they want things to excess, right? But there is an urge and a need. And what it feels like for them is, I need it, I want it, I must have it. And if that urge is big enough, people will go to any lengths to get what they want. This is why people, you know, and this is anyone on the spectrum, not on the spectrum, right? That there are things that they want. But imagine if you are someone on the spectrum and you don't have effective communication to tell someone anything that you want, not anything, or or that you don't want, right? How much more frustrating will that be? And maybe the lengths that you're willing to go will be that much stronger because you want it, right? So the kiddo who wants to be with his mom, or that wants to play with the ball and doesn't have a way to ask for it, right? Or wants to get into that room. We see kids that elope and go to be at a swimming pool that they couldn't get into, right? Because they want access to something. So this is called a tangible driven behavior. And what do we do if we know that that's what it is, that they want access to something? So what's the intervention for that? Well, the first thing is to teach them how to appropriately ask for it. It's so, you know, this is a hard concept, but it's true because it's so simplistic, right? That if you're able to request, if you're able to communicate what you want, you are always more likely to get it. So shouldn't we focus on that? That seems like a pretty important thing to me. So we always want to be teaching the person how to appropriately ask for that. And it's important that we do this all the time, not just when the behavior is happening, right?
So if the child is grabbing donuts and shoving them into their mouths, it's really hard to teach this then. So what we try to do is teach it outside the moment before it's necessary, as much as possible, yeah? Then, here's the hard part, because as much as I've said, we want to make it so that the person can get to the thing that we want, but what we have to do is cut off the blood supply to the previous way that they were doing it. Because in their minds, they have learned, well, what I do when I want the donut is that I throw myself on the floor and grandma then gives me a donut. It works for me. It's, you know, it may not be effective because it doesn't work when I do it at school, but it works when I do it with grandma, so I'm going to keep doing it. So what we have to do is teach them how to appropriately ask, and we do that first, right? But then we only give it to them when they ask appropriately. That means that when they're throwing the tantrum and you're aware what they really want is the donut, but they're throwing a tantrum, that we do not give the donut. We just don't. And we, once we have taught the proper way to ask, we only give it when there is an attempt. And it may that they don't get, maybe that they don't get it perfect, right? Like, and we're going to decide based on the skill level of the individual. It's very individualized, but maybe for Joey to ask for a donut, all he has to do is point to a picture of a donut that's on the wall. Maybe that's what's appropriate for him. But maybe the 16-year-old who is verbal, we teach them to say, excuse me, can I have a donut, please, right? I mean, there's all different ways that you can request a donut. But whatever we've decided is the way, and we teach that individual, then that is the only time that we allow them to have the donut. And a lot of people get very fatutzed about that and go, you're denying them the donut. No, we've taught something, and then we're going to give it when it is done in an approximation of the way that we have taught them. And remember that we're trying to do that so that the person learns, oh, it's so much easier. It's so much easier to point at the donut than have to throw myself on the floor. Because that's when the good life happens, right? Lori says, my son repeats his question 100 times until he gets some sort of response. Also likes wearing no clothes at any time. The clothing is a sensory thing, but the repetitive question, we're not sure yet. Okay. So let me ask you something. If what I wanted was a donut, and I don't know what the question is that he's asking 100 times, and maybe you should write to me, Laurie, but think about it. What is it that he wants? What is he trying to communicate to you, and what is it that he wants? With questions, it's tricky, because what I learned with my son, not necessarily what you're going to learn with your son, is that my son would ask me, for instance, what are we having for dinner? He learned that was a way that if he asked me that was a question that I was interested in because I like to talk about food. It's a problem I have. And then I would go, oh, well, you know, we're going to have this, that, and the other thing. But then 30 seconds later, he would say, what are we having for dinner? And I would go, what's happening? I just answered that question. Do you not remember? And like, were you not listening? Like, I would get in this whole other space in my head. And what we discovered was that was the only topic that he knew for sure that I would respond to. So he would just keep asking it because it was his way of communicating, I want to have your attention. I want to be communicating with you. I want you to be, you know, back and forth with me. And so what I learned was as a mom to say to him, ask him the question back. So if he asked me the question, what are we having for dinner? And I'd say, oh, we're having chicken and mashed potatoes. And then 30 seconds later, he would ask me, what are we having for dinner? And I would say, that's a great question. What are we having for dinner? And he would say, chicken and mashed potatoes. And then I would know that he knew the answer and that he was listening. And then I would ask him another question. And I would say, you know, something that I knew he wanted to talk about. I would say, which, you know, color car do you like? A million questions, right? Like, what game do you want to play when you see Jose again? Right? And then I would see the visible relief in him that we were having a conversation, that he had my undivided attention. Okay. So write in and tell me about, just checking what somebody wrote in.
Write in and tell me which questions is he asking, Lori, because there's a million reasons why somebody asks the same question over and over and over. But think about this. If I ask you, oh, my dog was doing this to me last night, you guys. My dog came over and, right? Which is, my dog doesn't, can't come up to me and say, I'm hungry and I would like biscuits. She doesn't have the ability to do that. So she came over to me and I was busy doing something else and I, you know, didn't attend to it right then. So then, you know, she came over and I was like, go lay down. And so she did for a couple of minutes. And then she came back over, right? And we did this dance like 22 times and she just persisted. Until I was like, what? What do you want? And like, you know, not good behavior on my part, but I was frustrated. And I was like, what do you want? And I got up and said, show me. And she took me right over to the cabinet because she wanted biscuits. And I got the biscuits for her and I gave them to her. Oops. What did I just teach her? That if you really want biscuits, just keep pestering mom until you get them. I don't know about behavior, right? But it's my dog, and I know that there are people who spend a lot of time teaching their dogs to speak and have those buttons, and I'm choosing to do other things with my life, right? But with a child, that communication is going to be important their whole life. I absolutely want to take the time to teach them an appropriate way to ask for what you want so that you can get your needs met, right? But we also have to be listening. Shannon Kay says, my son does the same thing with questions, but he will repeat a statement until the other person repeats what he says. And, you know, I'm sure, Shannon, that part of that is the way he is meeting you right now and that he knows for sure that you've heard him. But, you know, you can work on that. He doesn't have to go through life having that. You can show him other signs that the person heard, right? And you can build trust with him so that he knows he's been heard. Because probably there was a period of time in which he was saying something and somebody either couldn't understand what he was saying and so he didn't get a need met and now he wants to make sure. If you think about it, it shows a whole lot of higher thinking that he's making sure that you heard him, right? But there are ways that you could work on that so that he can look for signs. Like, did they nod? Did they, you know, there are lots of different ways that we can be acknowledged that we were heard. Thank you. I love that we figured that out. But in any case, when we're talking about a tangible, what we want to make sure is that there is a way that they can get the thing that they're asking for. Now, I know some of you are like, well, what they're asking for, you know, we can't give it that often or we can't ever give it, but give some approximation of it. Because if they are, think about if you really, really, really needed or wanted something, right? You know, this is the core of who this person is. So figure it out. Sometimes this is a little bit of a conundrum. I love that Christina Adams, when her son was little, he just was so into planes and he wanted to see the airplanes all the time and he wanted to know how the planes worked. And she just decided, I'm just going to follow this until we get to the end of it. So, and she just took it incrementally. So there were books about airplanes. There were toy airplanes. Then she would take them to the airport and she would watch planes take off. And then eventually she paid for a pilot to take him in the cockpit and show him and go through the process of taking off in a small airplane. You know, I think it's important that we just don't, when they show an interest in something, that we not completely poo-poo it. So do the approximations. But on the other side of it, it can become what they call perseverative, where they're not able to do anything else. So it's really important to set up a schedule of access. We hear Temple Grandin talk all the time about how she wanted to play with the metal plate on her bed and sand, that she wanted to lift up sand and watch it go through her hands and speed it up and slow it down. And she still says fascinating stuff, right? And so we can't just say, no, you can't ever have access to that. We set up a schedule and say, and we can show pictures and say, first we're going to do this and then we're going to play with the sand. Right? You can, and you don't you know, people go, well, my child won't understand that. But if you use pictures, you can get a child to understand that. I encourage you to be working with a team, but understand that if we find that it's that they want something, we have to teach them the appropriate way to ask for it, and we decide what that is appropriate for them, not for society, for them, at their skill level. That, you know, in some cases it will be pointing to an icon, it might be sign language, it might be a vocal request, it might be typing. I mean, there's lots of ways to communicate, but we give them a more effective way of getting what they want, asking for it. And then when they ask for it, we give it to them. Later, we can make it less often so that every time they ask for ice cream, we don't give it to them, right? But in the beginning, we want to teach them that if you ask appropriately, we'll give you ice cream because it's less hard than throwing a tantrum, yeah? But the second one is hard too. You have to only give it to them when they're asking appropriately. Whatever the thing was you decided to teach it to them, that's when you give it to them. Okay, moving on. Let's go to our next one. Attention. And I'll tell you something. This is a lot of it. I'm a former school teacher, and we were taught this when I was teaching because I was at a good school that understood teachers' needs. We were taught these four functions, you guys. This is where I learned this, not when my child was diagnosed. I had to relearn it when my child was diagnosed, but I already knew this in the classroom. And the first thing I learned as a classroom teacher is that all kids have an attention bucket, and all kids need attention. Different kids need different amounts, and you got to keep topping that thing off. And some kids need very little attention, and they're happy with just the smallest amount of attention, but other kids are so needy. And this is not a judgment. It's an acknowledgement of, well, that's how much this kid needs to be happy. Just like my dog, I have two dogs and two biscuits, and they're happy for 24 hours. The other one, it's 48 biscuits, right? She's bigger. She burns more energy. That's how many biscuits it takes for her to be happy. I'm exaggerating only slightly. So everybody needs attention. And our kids on the spectrum are not unique in this. They need attention, but different amounts. And let's remember that negative attention is attention. I always say, if you don't believe that, just look at a tabloid. People who are attention-driven will, even if they have to do something that's really inappropriate, will do it to get attention. And they'll go to huge lengths to get attention. Here's a clue. If they only do it when other people are around and they don't do it when no one else is around, then it's attention, right? There are there's this epidemic of teens right now cutting themselves. And we've heard Dr. Grampuchet talk about this before, that so many people say, oh, well, you know, that's an automatic reinforcing. We're going to talk about that in a minute. And with some kids it is. But if they're only doing it so that people can notice, there's at least an element of attention to it. And it makes for a different intervention. So what do we do when it's attention? First of all, we have to, what? There it is again. Teach them how to appropriately get attention. And we set up a schedule for giving attention even when they're not requesting it. Because a lot of times when attention is needed, it comes on suddenly. And while we're teaching a person how to appropriately ask for attention, we still need to be filling the bucket. So we set up a literal schedule of giving them attention. Boy, I did this in the classroom and it worked like a charm. For my kids that were super needy, I just... like, you know, there are teachers now who have little buzzers that are on a timer, so it'll give them a buzz every minute, and they remember to, and that's a little prompt for the teacher to give, like, some soupçon of attention to that kiddo, going, good job. You know, some little amount of attention, because it keeps them maintained. I love this picture, because look at that moment of attention between this parent, well, or this adult and this child, right? There's a soccer ball between them, which sometimes, you know, we need to put something between us to be able to have this kind of contact, right? But there is communication that is happening here. And right now, this child, if we had a meter of how much attention they're getting, it would be like ding, 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 right? Now, with attention, it's hard because, especially if you're in a group setting at all, that you might make the decision, like we talked about with the tangible, that, okay, then I'm not going to give attention when they're asking for it inappropriately. So when the kiddo is, let's say that we determine that the kiddo is spitting, right? And the function of the behavior is that they want attention, because when I spit, that's when people give me attention. And we see that they're only spitting when they're in public, that they're never doing it in private, because spitting could be for other reasons than attention, right? But we, you know, they look at it and they go, okay, they look at it in a bunch of different ways. They go, okay, it's attention seeking, right? Then that means that not only are we going to teach them how to get attention, we're going to set up a schedule of giving them attention even when they don't ask for it, and we're going to stop giving it when they spit. Great. Wonderful. And I know the plan and everything is wonderful, but now, you know, my friend comes over and brings her son, who's 5, and does not understand the intervention that we're doing and is not signed off on it. And my son spits, and the 5-year-old goes, "Why? He's spitting. I don't like it when he spits. I don't." Now that's attention. So we have to try, we have to make every attempt to prevent them from getting attention with the challenging behavior. So if they spit and the 5-year-old starts to go, "Wow," we very quickly pick up the 5-year-old and go, "Hey, do you want to get some chocolate cake?" and spirit them away so that the attention is not given. We do whatever we have to do. It's hard. And sometimes it's impossible. I will tell you that when our therapists, there were things that my son would do, because my son was a comedian, right? And we would have clinics where the whole team would get together in one room, and my son would do something because he knew that it was going to make people laugh. And at the time, the therapists didn't have iPads back then. They had clipboards because it was the dark ages. And my son would do something, and I would see the clipboards go like this and the shoulders are going like this, but they didn't want him to see that he had indeed made them laugh, right? So they were cutting off the attention, and it wasn't a big production number. They just would take their clipboards and put them in front of their face so that he could not see the reaction that he was getting. So we do what we have to. You make every attempt, but it's the hardest part with attention, right? Okay, so I want to be clear, though, that with attention, we're going to stop giving attention when they're engaged in the behavior that we know is for attention. But this is where people lose their minds, because they simplify it and go, "Okay, I just ignore the child." No. No, that is not it. Hear me when I say this, and I'm putting my loving arms and thoughts around you. We don't ever ignore a child. Ever, ever. We don't ever ignore a child. We will sometimes ignore behavior, but only when we know already that it is attention driven, right? And we've taught them another way to get attention. Because what happens so often, and it makes me want to beat my head against a brick wall, is that people decide, "Oh, you know, my child is over there and they're beating the crap out of their younger brother," and they go, "Oh, well, we're ignoring that." No, no, that is not the ticket. The only time we ignore behavior, and by the way, again, we don't ignore the child. The only time we ignore behavior is when we already know that it's attention driven and we're ignoring that behavior, but we've taught them an appropriate way to ask. But if the child is hitting someone, there's a way that we can go over and stop it without giving it attention. What we do is we go over and we, you know, very gently motor the child away from the thing where he's hurting or himself or somebody else. We don't talk about it. We don't make eye contact. We just motor them. And sometimes that's harder when the kid is bigger, right? But you don't just say, "Okay, I'm completely ignoring it," and wait for them, you know, for blood to be drawn. That is not the ticket. So I suggest that if you are at this point with your child, and on Wednesday we're doing a talk about aggression where we're going to talk about this again, right? But if, okay, my whole desk just went flying. It's all right. We're all good. Anyway, it's that kind of a day, you guys. Oh, that was super duper fun. All right, we're all alive. It's all good. Anyway, it's all good. But my point is, when we're talking about aggression next week, it's really important that we don't ignore the child and that we don't ignore what is being communicated. But if we know that it's for attention, we can distract and deflect and block and do a bunch of other things. So don't panic. We'll be covering that more. But don't ignore the child. I think it's my biggest issue, because this is dangerous. If you are ignoring behavior, and remember our first slide when we talked about what is it that they want. A child who is acting out at that level because they want attention, if we are not giving them attention another way, then we are just, oh, it's so cruel and mean what we're doing to them by ignoring them. And they're desperate for attention, so make sure you're giving attention, you know, for other things and on a schedule. Make sure that they're having that attention, and you'll find that the attention-seeking behavior will slip away. Don't be on the wrong end of this. Okay. Okay, now let's talk about escape. So escape maintained behavior is when they're doing it to escape from a person, from sensory input, from a feeling, a task, a fear, a place. We all engage in escape maintained behavior. We all do this all the time. Ask me about taxes and I will show you my best escape maintained behavior. I can come up with a million things to do so that I don't have to deal with taxes. I absolutely can, right? Everyone does this, but for our kiddos on the spectrum, if I don't have a way of communicating it, this can be so dangerous. If I don't have a way of saying I need to be away from that, I need to move away from that, so very dangerous. So this becomes often life and death. We have to start with empathy and understand that if they are trying to get away from something, that there is a reason why. And we have to compassionately figure out how to mitigate the escape issue. And if we don't, we're truly failing the individual. So we're going to start with teaching how to appropriately ask for help, breaks, distance, headphones, something that can take the edge off of it. If it's noisy and we can't take the person out of the noisy environment, can we put headphones on them? You know, this is where you have to like really think outside the box, right? There are some instances where once we have figured out, okay, it's escape-maintained behavior, that they're doing it to get out of it, that we will then prevent them from being able to get out of it. But this is so important that we do this compassionately. So a great example of this is that my son didn't like to write. Writing was the thing that, you know, and he would engage in whatever challenging behavior he had to in the classroom or at home to get out of writing. Now, we didn't know why that was. We were trying to find it out, and eventually we discovered that he had an eye issue, that the being able to see what he was writing was very hard for him. He couldn't focus on it, so he didn't want to do it. It made him feel funny. It made him feel dizzy. He didn't like it, so he didn't want to do it. And he would do everything to get out of writing. Now, there are some people who would be like, well, then don't make that boy ever write. Well, what a shame, because now my son is about to start his sophomore year in a very competitive program as a screenwriter. He has discovered that he is a writer, that is who he is in his soul. Is he someone who has stories to tell? I get goosebumps when I think about how important it is for who he has ended up being, that he is a writer. So how do we get from him like engaging that every BIP that we had when he was in school, behavior intervention plan, was for challenging behavior when he was asked to write? Well, one of the things that we did with our ABA team was that we saw that, for instance, when he would come home and it was time to do homework, what he would do is take his pencil and throw it on the floor. Then he would get down on the floor to pick up the pencil, and he'd waste like 5 or 10 minutes, and he'd start inspecting the carpet, and he would waste all of this time because he didn't want to do the homework because he didn't want to write. Right? And what we needed for him to see is that he could get to a reward for writing, because writing, he was going to have to write to get better at it, right? So what we did was we very mindfully and compassionately set up an intervention where there was a therapist and I was there. The therapist asked me to get an entire cup of pencils because the other thing he'd do is he'd press so hard that the point would break and then he'd go, I can't write. And then I'd have to go sharpen the pencil or get the pencil sharpener for him. And 10 minutes had passed and he got away with not doing it for 10 minutes. But during that 10 minutes, he wasn't getting better at it, you know? So we had the cup of pencils there that were all sharpened and we were set up and my son started to do his homework and we were both standing close by and he drops the pencil. And the minute he dropped the pencil, we had a plan and we'd rehearsed it. So we, you know, he would go to get on the floor to get the pencil, but I would block that. The therapist, while he was trying to get on the floor and going, wait a minute, what happened here? Put another pencil in his hand, and then I put his hand and put it on the paper. So we didn't allow the break to happen. And he was very frustrated because he wanted out of the behavior. What we did was we reinforced him heavily for the attempt and for trying and doing all of those things. And I'm good. We're fine. And but so it was hard, but we needed to get him out of this cycle so that he could get to the good part where he discovered that, hey, he enjoyed writing. And yes, down the road, what we did was we had it written into the IEP that he could choose to type any lesson that he wanted to. And he would choose to do that almost all the time. So my son's handwriting still is not brilliant. He's a great writer. He's a great writer. Who cares about, you know, he could be a doctor, his handwriting, right? But who cares? Because he's a great, great writer. So, but there are some things where we would not do this, about forcing them to do it and not allowing them to get the break, right? Like, obviously, if your child is afraid of heights, we're not going to take them to heights and force them to do it, okay? We notice that it says here on the slide that we slowly work on the tolerance of sensory issues, whatever those would be, and we're mindful in an intervention when fear or trauma are present. And if, you know, you've got to come from that place. You absolutely have to have empathy because when it's escape, there's something real that's happening. It doesn't mean, though, here's, I think, my point with all of this. It doesn't mean you just give up and go, oh, well, I guess then they're not going to be able to do that, right? But there is a mindful way of working on it so that they don't have to be stuck. I shiver when I think about what if we had just said, well, then he won't write. Then we're just not going to work on that. Then my son would not have found this deep, deep part of his soul that he tells me all the time, you know, Mom, I'm a writer. Okay. All right. Then our last one on the original four is automatic reinforcing, that there's something about the behavior that's an inside job, that it's giving them a reward on the inside. I put the picture here of somebody doing VR because it's a lot like when somebody's doing VR. They're looking at something and they're reacting to something, but you can't see what it is, right? You can ask them and maybe they can tell you, but sometimes, you know, they can't describe it for you, right? It's the same thing with something that's automatic reinforcing. So they're engaging in a behavior that something is happening internally for them that is rewarding enough that they want to keep do it. So again, we know that there's sometimes a behavior can have elements of more than one thing, but we talked about with attention that if they're not doing the behavior when no one is there, then it's definitely attention, right? But if they're doing the behavior even when no one is there, then we know that there's an element of automatic reinforcement because we know for sure they're not doing it for attention. And often a behavior can look like it's one of those, but this is a clear define. If they do it when nobody else is there, it's automatic reinforcing. If they only do it when other people are there, then there's automatically an element of attention to it. Okay, so I just need to say again that it's important that we acknowledge that there it does have a function. There is a reason for it. It's not random. It's not weird. And even though what they're doing may not be functional in that it's not actually meeting the need, And it could actually be something where they're hurting themselves. It is important to remember that there is a need there and we've got to safely replace it. I also have on this slide, for those of you who are watching the video podcast, that whenever self-injurious behavior is on board or somebody is hurting themselves or others, you really need to be having experts, because you could mess up and make it worse, right? If there is a need for something and you try to intervene and somehow you make that need greater, it can get worse before it gets better. So please be working with experts. However, there are some different things we should know about interventions for automatic reinforcing behavior. Again, we start with the same thing. It's a theme. Teach a more functional way of meeting the same need. So if what I'm doing is peeling the skin on my fingers because I've got a need, it's important that we figure out what the need actually is. Is it that you need something to do with your hands? Because there are all kinds of fidgets that we can give the person. Is it that you need to actually peel? Then, you know, we can put, glue on a surface and have them peeling it off so that the need is being met. But if it's that they're needing to scratch themselves, that's an entirely different intervention. But we need to give them a way that isn't hurting them. This is essential, right? Fill the need, fill it in a way that it doesn't hurt anything, in a more functional way. We have to, if it is automatic reinforcing and it's not self-injurious, we have to give them a way to get the need met. And sometimes a schedule is the thing. We already talked about that with Temple Grandin. We have to reduce and remove access to injurious elements. So, for instance, if, you know, what they're doing is not so much scratching themselves, but taking, let's say, a pencil and digging into themselves with it until we can figure out what the function of the behavior is and have it met a different way, we've got to remove the pencil so that they're not digging the pencil into their hands. You've got to work on this safely, right? We also want to ask ourselves, is it necessary to work on this behavior? If it's automatically reinforced, like, you know, some of our kids flap, and is it necessary? Is it, like, if it's a three-year-old, there are some hand skills that we want the three-year-old to be doing. Can we work on that and still have the hand flapping on a schedule? If we can, why do we need to work on that? You know, I think a lot of times when I talk to parents, it's like, well, it looks weird. That's not a reason to work on something. I have to say this with all compassion, because there's a lot of things to work on, right? And just because it socially does things, maybe if it's the only issue that you have going on, maybe, but still give them the schedule, right? Don't just willy-nilly try to cut things out of their lives because it looks weird, right? Remember, there is no weird. It's not random. And so it says right there, don't just seek to eliminate behavior. Seek to substitute it with something that fills the need, that works better for the individual first. That has to be the priority. This is where we get things twisted up sometimes, that sometimes we're working to reduce a behavior because it makes Dad uncomfortable, or it makes Mom, or it makes Aunt Beth uncomfortable. And you know what I say to that? Let's get some counseling for Mom, Dad, or Aunt Beth. Let's not disrupt the child's life and what they need for somebody else's need. Let's put the priority on the individual. Be compassionate, but don't ignore, right? Because I also think, too, that it's very hard. This is a fine line, because we have some parents who just go, well, that's the way he expresses himself, and so that's the way it's going to be. And somebody is left doing a behavior, and every year that goes by, it becomes harder to change that behavior when we could have given them a more effective way of getting that need met. You know? So I don't want to say too much more about that. People get heated about this. Be compassionate. Okay. Now, I promised you that there's a fifth one, right? Four usual suspects, but the fifth one is control. And we see this younger and younger now. It used to be that this was something that maybe around 11 with girls, we would see this come to pass. And, With boys, maybe it's a little bit later, but now we're seeing it with younger and younger kids. And you can tell when there is an element of control there because you see a great deal of anxiety. Sometimes we will see an individual do the exact opposite of the thing that they want. The parents will write in and say to me all the time, well, my child loves Legos. And we were in this moment where we were telling them, you know, we're not going to do this, but you can have Legos instead. And the kiddo was like, I'm not playing with the Legos. And what, you know, when they don't want the thing you know that they want, like, you know, what is this, right? But that's a sign that it's about control. And kiddos that have very rigid rules, it has to be this way, we have to go down this street, the cars have to be exactly lined up like this, that have meltdowns whenever anything changes. Those are all signs that control is at play, especially when you see that anxiety piece. This becomes really important. Now, I think we all understand this one the best, right, as adults, because we walk around, I don't know, maybe it's just me. maybe I'm just telling on myself. But I certainly, there's a large part of my day that has to do with anxiety about control. And I've had to learn this for me as an adult, that when I'm having anxiety, it's because there's some element of something that I feel that I can't control that I want to control. And if I will stop myself and talk it through, and by the way, I learned this in cognitive behavioral therapy, and go, hey, what's happening here? And ask myself, do I have any control over that? No, I don't. What do I have control over? And then I take action in that, then I can reduce my anxiety without meds. It's great. But how do we do this for our friends and our kiddos and our teens and adults that are on the autism spectrum? Well, the first thing we have to do is we have to give them choices. And that we have to give them as much possible control as we possibly can. Now, sometimes this seems like it's ridiculous because if it's an 8-year-old on the autism spectrum, let's be honest, there's not a whole lot of things that they have control over. Right? They have to go to school. They have to get dressed. They have to wear clothes, right? And these are the rules that we have to adhere to the rules. But within those, ask yourself, what could we let them control? Well, you can totally let them control the clothes that they are wearing. And you can control which choices you give them. You can put two outfits out and you can say you can wear this or you can wear that, right? And you know, you can make it as reinforcing for them as possible. Remember when parenthood started and the boy was being diagnosed and one of the symptoms was that he only wanted to wear his pirate outfit to school and he only had one pirate outfit and the parents were like, what are we going to do? You know, and I would tell you, if we're coming at this from a place of compassion, I know parents that have made the same shirt and the child wears the same, but you know, it's the same material, it's the same shirt, but they have 8 of them and they do the laundry. So there's some in the laundry and there's some in the drawer, right? And the kiddo wears the same thing every day. I'm just going to say, who's it hurting, right? So, you know, giving them a choice. Well, you know, here are the choices. I didn't give you the choice of not wearing anything, but within the, you know, you can wear this that's super soft and doesn't have tags, or you can wear this. And listen, other kids like things that are a little stiffer. I don't understand it. I don't have to. It's individual, right? But let them be in control as much as possible and then teach them coping strategies for when control isn't possible. Now, with a teen and an adult who understands language, cognitive behavioral therapy, help me, right? I'm the poster child. It helped me. When kids are younger, we give other strategies. My son, we learned that he would crash into people because he wanted to the sensory input from that, right? So we tried to teach him what were the things that he could do to give himself sensory input. And when he was younger and they would sit on the mat, he would sit and squeeze his little feet. And then we taught him how to squeeze his hands and how to sit and give himself a hug. And then as he got older, You know, there are things that we taught him. I'm doing all of them because these are things you could be sitting in a meeting and talking to other people. And if you're having anxiety, you know, you can give yourself a little self-massage. Even in the high-level meeting, you can be doing that. Or be rubbing a place on your palm. And those are all coping strategies. And it's, you know, that's a drop in the bucket compared to all the things that you could do. But it's so variable, right? So what is the issue that they're having? What do they need to have control over the moment, right? We teach them how to deal with it when you don't, because it can be as simple as putting your hand down on the desk and then in your brain, nobody else sees, but registering, I feel the pressure of my hand and talking to myself, which mitigates some of the anxiety that I'm feeling. But here's the thing. So important that we not take away control as a punishment. There was a case a couple of years ago of a parent who wrote to me, and his son wasn't living with him all the time, but he would come and visit, and there were younger kids in the house. And you know, what would happen is that he would be sent to his room and he would have a meltdown whenever he got to his room. And dad was saying, I just don't even understand this. You know, he likes his room is wonderful. But then the more we talked about it, the more that we saw that what he wanted to do was be in control of where he was. And so when they would say to him, you have to go be in your room, you have no control anymore of who you're talking to, that for that kiddo, that was the ultimate in loss of control. It was like being in prison. And he hated it, and he would have the mother of all meltdowns. And so they found other consequence strategies if something was happening, that let's say he was starting to escalate, right? And they didn't want that to be around the other kids. Instead of saying to him, you have to go to your room, they learned that they could say to him, hey, you're starting to escalate. Where would you like to go to have a moment to get yourself together? You choose. And sometimes he would choose to go to his room to do a breathing exercise before coming back. But you see, it was his choice about which one to go to. It was not a punishment. It was just a discussion that they could say to him, hey, buddy, you're escalating. You know, I see you're having a hard time. Where do you want to? And they taught him strategies for how to deal with it, but then they gave him the choice, where do you want to go and work on it? Shannon Kay says, yes, this is exactly my 5-year-old son. Last year, he wore the same yellow shirt every single day to school until December. And you know, like, these becomes the stories that are our lives. And other people might look at that and go, what are you doing? And I just say to you, they have no idea what you're doing, and you're working on so many other things that are so much more important. If being in a yellow shirt is what makes him happy, great. There was the story a couple of years ago about the kiddo that he had this shirt that he loved, and they bought so many of them, and then the shirt was discontinued. And they kept buying them in larger sizes and so on and so forth. And so there was a thing on the internet where people were like, does anybody have this? And they found the person who had the fabric. They went to great lengths to continue to make shirts to make this person happy. I think that we should do that. Now, if it gets to the point where, you know, at a certain point there was going to be no fabric left in the world, and I think if you have time, you teach them coping strategies to deal with a little bit at a time another shirt. They don't have to be stuck in that mode forever, but it's about being conscious and making choices about, is this the thing to work on right now? And if he's 5 and he's going to school and he's doing okay, if he wears a yellow shirt and we're working on a bunch of other things, I applaud you. You probably did a lot of laundry. And maybe now, you know, maybe now it's time to go and see if you can have a yellow shirt with a design on it. I don't know. But happiness cannot be underrated, right? Okay. So here we have our lovely owl who says, what is an FBA? So an FBA is a functional behavior assessment. It is done by experts, and it is a series of things that are done to figure out what the function of the behavior is. And it is the only really definitive way to make sure that you've got the right function. Now, there are a lot of different ways that you know, you can armchair quarterback it for yourself. I will also tell you that skillsforautism.com has back. Oh, good, Shannon. I see. Yes, we did similar. Shannon, you're killing it. You're doing such a good job. He wears any color shirt now. See, we can get there. We can get there. That was my half Humpty. I just did. But anyway, so Skills for Autism has something called a BIP builder, and it is not the whole program. If you call over there to ask them, ask for just the BIP builder. In that, they have something called the CIFA. The CIFA stands for a Card Indirect Functional Assessment. So it is a very researched and effective way of figuring out what the function of a behavior is. It's awesome. I wish that it was more available in more ways, but you can pay for it. And I don't know how much it is, but it's not. We talked about this on the show the other day. It's, if you buy the whole of Skills, which is this behemoth, that's, I think, $75, $79 a month. But the BIP builder for one child is infinitely less expensive. But basically, and the CIFA is just a part of it, it goes through, it asks you a bunch of questions. You know, does the behavior do this? Do they do it when someone's there? And it asks all these questions. And at the end, it creates a report for you. And it says, here is what we believe the function to be. It's attention with a little bit of escape. And you go, oh, which will change the way you intervene, right? So, because what we want to do, especially when it's challenging behavior, is be effective at dealing with this behavior, right? We want to redirect it in the right way. So we create a behavior intervention plan, some of which we've talked a little bit about, right? But a very precise behavior intervention plan takes into consideration all of the research that's been done on the function of the behavior, has a clear definition of what the behavior is and what it looks like. It has an antecedent modification, and it has a consequence strategy. So antecedent modifications are things that we do to try to prevent the behavior, including teaching a more functional way of getting what you want. If we leave that out, we have failed. It's a bad BIP. And a good BIP also has a consequence strategy for when the behavior happens. How am I supposed to react? What do I do? Because that will determine success. If I don't know that I'm not supposed to laugh hysterically when they do something and it's attention driven, then we're going to have much more of this behavior, right? I have to know what to do. Now, in the school, it's so important that everybody understand the BIP because, as I said earlier, you can have everybody on board and be, you know, taking care of a challenged behavior. But if you have a leak somewhere, then the behavior will continue to happen, and it might continue to happen in all settings. A great example that when my son was little, before, you know, he was between the age of 3 and 4, he wasn't even starting preschool yet, and we were doing intensive ABA at home. We had the best team. Oh my gosh, such a good team, right? And the only time that he wasn't with me or with our ABA team was when he would go to school once a week to have an hour of OT, and there was there were two times a week where he would go and have a half an hour of speech. That was the only time, and I wasn't allowed to be at either one of those things, whatever. And my son started hitting me in the head. And we talked about it with the ABA team, and we had a behavior intervention plan. They did a functional behavior assessment, and they found that there was an element of attention to it, and so they said, you know, they worked with me to figure out how to do an antecedent modification, how to give him more attention on a regular basis, how if I messed up and he hit me, how to, you know, first of all, how to block it and so on and so forth, but if I messed up and he was able to make contact with me, how I would react, which is that I would block it from happening again, but there were no words, I didn't, you know, do anything, but you know, I would remove him from me so that he definitely did not get the attention. Not ignoring the child, but and not fully ignoring the behavior, but not giving it attention, okay? And this, great. And we saw almost immediate improvement. Fabulous. Wonderful. And then it started happening again. And we were like, huh, what's going on here? And they said, well, is there anybody that else that he's hitting that's giving him a reaction? No. No, it's not happening. It's just not happening. And so now it's like, you know, this big discussion. Do we have the right function? Is it possible that there's another element to it? And I will tell you, we're going to talk about this on Wednesday. But with hitting, sometimes it starts out being for one function, but then it becomes automatically reinforcing because they like the feel of when they hit something. And we don't want that, right? So we began to be worried about that. And then one day I picked him up from OT. And as he walked out, he just... to the OT person who went, oh, hey, don't you? And I went, what just happened? Why, you, like, what's going on? And she was like, oh, yeah, he does that pretty much every session now. It's like, you didn't tell us? We have an intervention for that. And what, and that, is that how you react every time? Because she was not part of the behavior intervention plan. So, word to the wise, make sure that all the professionals that you're working with understand what the behavior is, what it looks like, what the behavior intervention plan is, and how to carry it through. Because that is pivotal, pivotal, pivotal important. I will also tell you that they will tell, you know, the professionals around you will tell you that they understand all aspects of what we just talked about, and then they will do something that is not in alignment with what we just talked about. They won't bring compassion to the table. They'll intervene on something that is not helping the individual, but is helping everybody else. And I tell all of you, be careful, be mindful, be compassionate, but hold people to a very high standard when they're working on changing a challenging behavior. Make sure that your child is being dealt with in a professional way and that their needs, that it's about making sure that they have a more effective way of getting their needs met. Lori says, we have our son a trampoline for the sensory and the pounding, and he loves it too. Yeah, and sometimes kids need the drums. That you get a pair of bongos, and they bang it out in the drums, and that sensory need is filled, right? So we're replacing. We're not trying to ectomy anything. If you're coming from a place where your child is doing something and you're like, we got to get rid of that, I'm just going to ask you to back up and think about that. There's a reason why they're doing it. There's a need that's being met. It may not be functional. It may not be in your child's best interest the way that they're doing it. So yes, we want to intervene, but we're not going to be effective unless we replace it with something that's more effective. That's the key to the whole thing. And what will happen is you will have a happier child because their needs. Remember that first slide that we were on where we talked about, I think that was the last slide. Let's make sure. Yeah. Oh, look, I there's stuff about this in my book too. And you know what? I put this up there because that's my guy. That is my little, when he was little. That's what I looked like when I was in all of this intervention. Notice the white hair now. I was dying it then. It was white then too, and I was dying it. But that's one of my favorite pictures because you know what that is? I'm a cry. That's a picture when we were in process. My guy had the hardest time making eye contact and couldn't look in the camera. And that's a picture of when he was trying to work on it. And so it's a little bit like, I'm going to do the big eye thing. He's not like that now. But that's a picture of, and I was wearing a backpack purse because that was what they told me I needed to do because I kept having problems with my purse whenever we were trying to intervene on something. You do what you have to do, right? And that meant I could only have a purse that was a backpack. But I, man, how much do I love that little boy? And here's the thing. We all want what's best for our kids. Even though we've had to talk about in school, we can only want what's appropriate. We all want what's best for our kids. And what's best is for them to be able to tell us what they need and to communicate with us to say, I need a break. I need a moment. I need a hug. I need your attention. I need you. I need you to step back. I need space, right? And we would give anything for our kids to be able to communicate with us that. And I'm going to guarantee you that whatever your child is doing today that's kicking your can the most is their way of communicating with you. So write to me if you have any questions. And there's much more in the book. And that book is available right now on all major booksellers. But this is why it's important to me that I share, because that little guy starting his sophomore year of college. Oh, I'm getting melancholy here. But it's all worth it, you guys. You're doing a good job. Stick with it. And I promise you, things will be revealed to you. But if you keep in that mindset about what is it they want? How are they trying to communicate with me? How can I teach them a more effective way to communicate? And there's my phone. It's time to go. We'll be back tomorrow with Dr. Graham Bichet. Don't forget that tomorrow we're answering your questions about last week's show about how do you tell the difference between good ABA and bad ABA. So join us then. Until then, give your kiddos a hug from me and one for you too. Bye-bye for now.